Welcome to the third in our series of lectures and discussions of Menachem Begin, Israel's sixth prime minister, who we have been calling Israel's Jewish prime minister, because we're going to argue, as we've seen, that he is really the one who brought a kind of a Jewish soul to the Jewish state. And today we're going to see that reflected particularly in one incident, but we're going to look at two incidences. We're going to look at the incident of the Altalena and the incident having to do with reparations, both of which are immediately after the Declaration of Independence in 1948. So just to review quickly, in the first lecture we covered the period from Begin's birth in 1913 until his arrival in Palestine in the spring of 1942 at the age of 29. We talked about the love of Tanakh and his family, the deep sense of abiding loyalty to the Jewish people, the Beitar ethos of Hadar, the notion of revolt, and the destruction, of course, of European Jewry. Then last time we talked about the period between Begin's arrival in 1942 until essentially on the eve of 1948 and the Declaration of Independence. We talked about his being in hiding, the multiple attacks and recriminations between the Haganah, the Irgun, the Lehi, the British, the King David Hotel building bombing, the Sergeant's Affair, Deir Yassin, and we covered the changing historical notions of Deir Yassin. And by the way, we should have mentioned last time that there's a man named Bruce Huffman, who's at Georgetown University, an expert in terrorism and counterterrorism, who has argued that while, as we know, the Irgun was much, much smaller than the Haganah numbering somewhere between 40 to 60,000, and the Irgun probably about 5,000. Bruce Huffman believes that it was actually the Irgun that ultimately got the British to leave Palestine because of the impregnability, so to speak, of the King David and then what happened there. While Begin was in hiding, he had two more children, as we know, his two daughters. And I think it's also important to note that we should remember what his situation was. He had no real reason to think he was necessarily going to survive the hiding. He had no real reason to be sure, given how hard the British were hunting for him, that he was going to live to see the rise of the state. And so to have these two children is essentially an extraordinary statement of faith in God, in the future of the Jewish people, in the almost inevitability of the rise of a Jewish state, and so forth. And I think it's also very important for us to note that when the Jewish state is founded in 1948, Menachem Begin is 35 years old. He has been the head of Beitar in Europe. He has been in Soviet prison. He has been in the Polish Free Army. He has run the Irgun. He has chased the British out of Palestine, and he's 35 years old. His career is actually just getting started, but it is an extraordinary set of accomplishments for someone that young, and because we tend to have images of him as an older man, because that's when he became internationally famous, he's a young man at this point, unbelievably accomplished. The first of the two incidents that we're going to look at today, the Altalena and then reparations, the Altalena takes place in June of 1948, which means that it's the month after the Declaration of Independence. The War of Independence was, of course, a very complicated war. We mentioned last time that there are really two segments to it. One is a Jewish fight against irregular soldiers, Jordanian fighters mostly. It's almost like a civil war between local Arabs and Jews. And that ends on May 14, 1948, when Israel is attacked by five countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq. Iraq, of course, did not even share a border with Israel, but joined the fighting anyway. Those are the two basic parts. There were also two major ceasefires in the War of Independence, which is an exceedingly complicated war, which we're not going to have time to go into. But the first ceasefire is critically important for our story. It begins on May 28, 1948, which is about 2 weeks after the state is created, and it's a ceasefire for 28 days. And during those 28 days, the rules are that neither side is allowed to import more weapons, and neither side is allowed to try to improve its military position in the field. Now, it was obvious to everybody that both sides were going to import weapons, and it was obvious to everyone that both sides were going to try to improve their position in the field, but it was very important to Menachem Begin's rival, David Ben-Gurion, that Israel not be caught breaking the ceasefire. He was obviously very concerned about this new country and its international reputation. Harry Truman had recognized it a few weeks earlier, 11 minutes after Israel was declared. But Ben-Gurion is very, very concerned, and quite rightly so, about the reputation that this country is going to have, and he's made it clear there can be no apparent violations of the ceasefire. Ben-Gurion also had other very serious issues that he was dealing with. He was trying very hard to rope all three paramilitary organizations into one. That was no small thing, since all three had reported to different commanders, and all three had actually at various times attacked each other. So to say that all of a sudden Irgun Mem and Lechi Men are going to report to people in the Haganah who might have been people that turned them in the Saison or so on and so forth was very, very complicated, and nobody was terribly happy about this organizational structure. But Ben-Gurion understood that a state worth its name could have only one fighting force, and the multiplicity of forces simply had to end. Begin and Ben-Gurion signed an agreement about the Irgun joining the Haganah, therefore Tzva Haganah Yisrael, but it is a complicated agreement with neither side trusting the other very much, and it's also an oblique agreement, which has some phrase about the IDF, Tzahal, being the only legitimate fighting force within the state of Israel. That's going to become an important question, because Jerusalem was not part of the state of Israel as far as the UN map was concerned, and it was really not being very ably defended by Jewish fighters. So if it was in the state of Israel, then theoretically, according to the agreement, Begin could not have any of his men working there. On the other hand, if Jerusalem was outside of the state of Israel, he might have had a legitimate reason to think that he could have the Irgun fighting in Jerusalem, which he did, trying to defend it. So we're now in the second half of May. There is a ceasefire that begins, as we said, on May 29th, 1948, and is going to go through June. In the meantime, all across the Atlantic Ocean, there is a group of Irgun operatives who are much more radical than Begin and his fellow leaders, and they include Ery Jabotinsky, Zev Jabotinsky's son. And Ery Jabotinsky and others buy a boat, which they call a real ship, which they call the Altalena. Altalena had been Jabotinsky's pen name in Italy. Apparently in Italian it means seesaw or swing set. And for whatever reason, that's the pen name that Jabotinsky took. And they named the boat after Jabotinsky. And they pick Eliyahu Lenkin. Some of you who know the area near Shalem College where we're recording this know that there's a street named for Eliyahu Lenkin, which abuts Beitar Street, which is no accident. This is a whole neighborhood of streets named for these men. Eliyahu Lenkin will eventually become a member of Knesset and Israel's ambassador to South Africa, but at this point he is taken to be the commander of this ship. The ship sails around the Mediterranean posing as a cargo ship, and it does enough normal things, quote unquote, so that it will not appear suspicious. But then eventually it makes its way to Port de Bou in France, where it loads up 150 million francs worth of arms. That is an extraordinary amount of money even today. Back then it was an inconceivable amount of money. Most of the arms came from the French. Some were donated by other countries. We might ask ourselves, why were the French so interested in giving arms to Israel at this stage? They wanted to limit the influence of the British. The French and the British had been kind of quarreling over who was going to have what control in the Middle East ever since the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, and it had not been entirely resolved, and there appeared to be some French hope that if they loaded up Israel with arms, there might be some warm feelings on the part of Israel towards France, and that might push Israel to become more distanced from the British. So they are loading up the boat with 150 million francs worth of arms and 940 immigrants to Israel, all of whom, essentially except for a handful, were survivors of the war. So you've got an infinite amount of arms and almost 1,000 survivors of the war. And the ship sets sail on June 11th, about a month behind schedule. Now don't forget, the ceasefire is still in effect. It's going to be in effect for another couple of weeks. Menachem Begin has no idea that the Altalena has been purchased. He has no idea that the Altalena exists. He knows nothing of the loading of arms. He knows nothing of the boarding of all of these immigrants. He has absolutely no idea. And in fact, he learns about the Altalena from listening to London radio, which he did all the time. And he is immediately horrified that London radio has reported that there is a ship that has been bought by the Irgun, which is making its way from France to Palestine. He has no way of knowing where the ship is, but he is, of course, panicked. And he reaches his radio operator and tells her to write the ship or to communicate with the ship right away and to tell the ship, by no means in any way should you approach Israeli territorial waters. But she had mistyped the code. So the ship never actually received the message. And then apparently she typed it incorrectly a little bit later, but there have been so many garbled messages by that point that the ship simply began to ignore them. There were others on the ship who later on said they had a hunch that they knew what the message was and they chose to ignore it. We don't know exactly why the ship continued towards territorial waters of Israel, but we know at the beginning at least it's because they had not been told not to and they did not get Begin's urgent message. Begin understands that this is an enormous problem for him personally and his trust with Ben-Gurion, which was virtually nil, but at least somewhat fledgling. And he also understood, of course, that this was an enormous problem for Israel, which could not be caught with a ship filled with arms sailing right in front of everyone into a port on the coast. So he goes and he meets with Ben-Gurion and the government, and he tells them, quite truthfully, that he knew absolutely nothing about this ship. We don't know if David Ben-Gurion believed Menachem Begin. I think that the evidence is on the side that Ben-Gurion knew that Begin was telling the truth, but there are people who argue otherwise, and certainly Ben-Gurion himself, in the aftermath of what will become a very complicated affair, reports to the government that he was certain from the very beginning that Menachem Begin was working him over and lying completely. Now, Ben-Gurion had three problems. Number one, he desperately needed the arms. This is a ship filled with arms that Israel desperately needs. Number two, he's worried about violating the embargo in public. And number three, he's very worried about Menachem Begin. He didn't trust Begin at all. Begin didn't trust David Ben-Gurion. And it's the complete lack of trust between these two men. Begin is 35. Ben-Gurion is 62. They're of different generations. They're of different dispositions. They're of different ideologies. They're of different backgrounds. Everything is adding up for them to not trust each other and so forth. The first thing that Ben-Gurion does is to tell Begin to have the ship go to Kfar Vitkin. Kfar Vitkin is about 10 kilometers north of Netanya and about 40 kilometers north of Tel Aviv. And Ben-Gurion's thought was, it's away from Tel Aviv, it's away from Haifa, it's away from lots of people, it'll be better for it to dock there, there'll be many fewer people to see what's going on, hopefully less United Nations people, hopefully less people of all different sorts, and that's exactly what happens. The ship actually goes to Kfar Vitkin, and while the ship is making its way to Kfar Vitkin, Begin and Ben-Gurion end up in a serious and very conflictual negotiation about what's going to happen with the arms. To David Ben-Gurion, it was exceedingly clear what was going to happen with these arms. There was one army in Israel. The ship was approaching Israel. The Irgun had no right whatsoever to be operating anymore. The Irgun was risking Israel by violating the embargo anyway. All of the arms were going to Tzahal. Begin had a very different attitude. He had an attitude that, first of all, Jerusalem needed to be defended because it was Jerusalem. He also had a lot of his own fighters who were in Jerusalem desperately trying to hold out against Jordanian forces, and they were running out of, among other things, ammunition, food and water too, but they were running especially out of ammunition. And he wanted at least some of the arms to be given to his soldiers in Jerusalem, which he said to Ben-Gurion isn't really part of the state of Israel according to anybody's map. I'm not violating our agreement by doing so. But needless to say, David Ben-Gurion was going to have none of it, and they didn't really reach agreement. By June 18th, the ship is in Crete, who, for those of you who know the map, know that Crete is unbelievably close to, dangerously close to Israeli territorial waters. And Israel Galili, who's the chief of staff of the Haganah, makes a deal with Begin that 20% of the arms could be used in Jerusalem. But he didn't say who would get to use the arms in Jerusalem. It wasn't clear if he thought the Etzel could use them in Jerusalem or if Tzahal would send troops to Jerusalem. But to make matters worse, and nobody trusting anybody else, rumor has it that this ship is coming to Kfar Vitkin, and rumor has it that Menachem Begin is on his way to Kfar Vitkin to meet the ship. Now you have to understand that for many of these men, when they were fighting for the Etzel, and they're now fighting for Tzahal in groups that they don't feel like being a part of because they don't trust the Tzahal fighters. They had fought for all those years for Begin. Begin was their hero, Begin was their commander, and they'd never met him. They'd never seen him because he'd been in hiding for all those years. And they understood that if they went to Kfar Vitkin, they might actually get to see or maybe even meet Menachem Begin. So some numbers of them, we don't know whether it was several dozen, a couple of hundred, it's not clear at all. All of this is very much clouded in the fog of war. But some, to what Ben-Gurion was, significant number of Eitzel soldiers leave their military units in Tzahal and make their way to Kfar Vitkin. From their point of view, they just wanted to meet their hero. From Ben-Gurion's point of view, of course, it looked like they were abandoning their units and going to regroup as the Etzel, and he, of course, was not going to have it. He goes back to the cabinet. He reminds them once again that now he's facing desertion in addition to everything else. Begin was lying, he says. Something has to be done. Galili, who realizes that his suggestion that 20% of the arms be used in Jerusalem wasn't working, probably because Ben-Gurion wasn't so keen about it anyway, and certainly because Begin was never going to allow it if it was not allocated to Irgun forces, Galili decides that the ship has to be bombed. He knows that there are 1,000 Jews, almost 1,000 Jews, 940 Jews who are survivors of the camps on the ship. He knows that the ship has an infinite number of arms that the young, desperate state of Israel really, really, really needs. But he decides that he's going to have the ship bombed, and he orders a couple of the planes from the very, very new Israeli Air Force to go and bomb the ship. Many of you probably know that the earlier days of the Israeli Air Force, it was basically a day, it was an era of American pilots flying planes for Israel. And if you've not seen the really extraordinary movie by Nancy Spielberg called Above and Beyond, it is an extraordinary movie by an extraordinary filmmaker. And it's the story of the Machal pilots, the pilots who volunteered to the army. Machal still exists, of course, in the Israeli army. And the Machal pilots refused the order. They just said to Galili, we did not come to the Middle East having fought in the Second World War, having survived the Second World War, having violated American law to come and fly here. We did not do all of that to come and bomb Jews. And they simply flat out refused the order. There weren't enough other pilots to actually do it, so Galili's idea of bombing the ship completely fails. The ship eventually does reach Kfar Vitkin, and you can imagine the chaos. Hundreds of Haganah soldiers, a lot of Irgun soldiers. Begin is actually there. The ship is unloading. It's not a Haifa port or an Ashdod port. It's not a great place for unloading boxes and crates and all of that. And the arms are being unloaded very, very slowly. There's a massive Haganah presence, as I said. And everybody's nervous that this is going to go to a very bad place. There was a whole series of negotiations, again, which we won't go into, who would get arms, where, when, whatever. But finally, ultimately, Galili gives Begin an ultimatum. He says he has 10 minutes to answer this ultimatum, and the ultimatum is this. Either Begin turns over all of the weapons of the ship to Tzahal, or Tzahal will use force, take action on the ship, and hold Begin personally accountable. Now, Galili apparently thought that in giving Begin the ultimatum, he was giving Begin an honorable way out. Because then Begin could say, what can I do? I mean, Galili gave me an ultimatum. He was going to use force. There was nothing that I could do, even though I wanted to keep the arms for my men. Begin, of course, did not think that there was anything honorable. Don't forget Hadar. Begin didn't think there was anything honorable at all about getting an ultimatum from somebody like Galili. And he just ignored it. And he said to people around him, oh, it's just bluff. We have nothing to worry about from those guys. The only people we all need to worry about is the UN. Begin, of course, completely misunderstood Ben-Gurion, just as Ben-Gurion continually misunderstood Begin as well. The Etzel tells Begin that they should get out of there. Kfar Vitkin is actually a Haganah stronghold. It's not going to end well if the ship stays in Kfar Vitkin, and things could get very nasty. And all of a sudden, as Begin is about to give the order to Lenkin to have the ship sail south from Kfar Vitkin towards Tel Aviv, fighting breaks out. To this day, we do not know why the fighting breaks out. Some people said that the Irgun people fired first in the air to let the Haganah know that they were not going to be trifled with. Some people say that people were testing their weapons. Some people think that the Haganah opened fire first on the Irgun. And some people believe that the Haganah was trying to kill Menachem Begin. There he was out in the open. This would be a battle. This would be a time when David Ben-Gurion could finish him off once and for all. We do not know, but we know that there was shooting. And there are people who describe the scene of utter chaos, obviously. Begin lying on the ground, cursing in both Yiddish and Hebrew, really unable to contemplate what is happening, given everything that he and the Jewish people had just been through. On the beach in Kfar Vitkin, Jewish soldiers are firing at Jewish soldiers. There were deaths. The Etzel lost 6 men and had 18 wounded, and the IDF lost 2 and had 6 wounded. And when Ben-Gurion found out about the deaths on the beach of Kfar Vitkin, the first thing that he said was, the dead men from the Etzel may not be buried in Tel Aviv. In other words, it was an extraordinary thing, given what we know about Jewish tradition and the honor given to the dead. Ben-Gurion, in an extraordinary and outrageous move, basically says they can be nowhere where there's a center of Jewish living. They can be buried somewhere else, not in Tel Aviv, where their graves could become a kind of a place that people would go. He just wasn't going to have it. Begin reboards the ship, extraordinarily enough. It's still, again, to this day, not entirely clear why he did that. We talked about the accusations that he left Poland too early and fled to Russia when he was the head of Beitar, which numbered some 60,000 young people. People said to him, the captain of the ship leaves last. There are those people who felt that that was still ringing in his ears, not that many years later, quite actually. And he boards the ship. He's not the captain, but in a certain way, of course, he is the captain. And he boards the ship as it sails down to Tel Aviv. The ship leaves Kfar Vitkin at 9:35 p.m. and arrives at midnight, which gives you an idea of just how very slowly the ship is creeping along. And it arrives and runs aground in Tel Aviv on the beach at what is today Frischmann Street. So it is just south of the Sheraton Hotel. On Frischmann Street right now is the Don Hotel. So if you've been to the Don Hotel or you know where the Sheraton is, it runs aground just outside there and very, very close to the shore. You run aground, you know, not far out in the ocean. You run aground outside the shore. But it's midnight and nothing much happens. The next day is June 22nd. Yigal Alon, who will of course become very famous later on in Israeli history and was one of the commanders of the Palmach prior, is the commander on the shore. Another commander of the Palmach, a young man named Yitzhak Rabin, just happens to be idling by. Literally, he wasn't called to it, but it was happening by, and he sees what's happening, and he's actually pressed into service. And firing breaks out once again as the arms are being unloaded, because there is no agreement. What is going to happen with these arms? What percentage is going to Tzahal? What percentage is going to the Irgun? What percentage is going to go to Jerusalem, but not under the Irgun? Nothing is clear, and fighting breaks out once again. One of the most chilling moments in this, to me at least, is that one of the Irgun people actually has made his way to shore. People were jumping off the ship and just basically wading their way to shore. It was in very, very shallow water. Runs up to Rabin and says to him, "Why are you shooting at Jews?" And Rabin said to him, "When Jews stop shooting at us, we'll stop shooting at Jews." And if you think for a moment about how Rabin lost his life, the idea that Rabin said in 1948, "When Jews stop shooting at us, we'll stop shooting at Jews," is really just kind of a chilling, horrifying coincidence. The firing does stop. But now Begin is also convinced that Ben-Gurion is trying to have him killed. And there's a kind of a standoff, and the Palmach brings cannons to the beach. And it gets this young man, Hillel Dolesky, who was an immigrant from South Africa. Dolesky, as an immigrant from South Africa, just like the Machal pilots, Mitnadvei Chutz La'aretz, did not want to be doing what he was being asked to do, which was to fire his cannon at the ship, which still had hundreds of Holocaust survivors on it. He tries to say no, and he's told, "You're in the army, an order is an order." He loads the cannon, and he fires a shot, and it misses to the south. He readjusts the cannon, and he fires, and it misses to the north. He fires a third time, and it misses again. He fires a fourth time, and he hits the ship. The ship, of course, is filled to the brim with ammunition. Fires start, explosions start, and very, very soon, the ship just simply starts to burn and explode everywhere. Begin, at this point, is carried off the ship by men who said, at least, that he did not want to leave, and bullets are flying all around him. Nonetheless, Begin does make it to shore, disheveled, some say without his glasses, some say hysterical. And he makes his way to a radio station where he calls on his men and he says, "No civil war with enemy at our gates." He says, "You may not fire on Hebrew soldiers." That's his phrase that he had used before, as we saw, a kind of a biblical image, not Jewish soldiers, not Israeli soldiers, but Hebrew soldiers, absolutely no fighting. And he said, "The enemy is the Arabs who are waiting at the gate. The enemies are not the Jews." But the fighting, which does eventually die down, does not die down immediately, and 10 more men of the Etzel are killed in the fighting. What you have here, really, about a month after Israel is created, a little bit more, is a civil war. There are men on both sides being killed. you really have a civil war in Israel, and it is Menachem Begin who will actually bring it to an end by telling his soldiers, it doesn't matter what happens, it doesn't matter who started, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what the score, quote unquote, is, no firing on Tzahal, and the shooting died down. There were a number of people killed on the Altalena. We, of course, won't go over all of them now, but it's important to know that one of them was Avraham Stavsky. Avraham Stavsky was a member of the revisionists. He was part of the Jabotinsky world, who was accused of the murder of Chaim Arlozorov on the Tel Aviv beach, not far from where the Altalena had now run aground. He was accused of having killed Chaim Arlozorov in 1933. Chaim Arlozorov was killed by whoever killed him because he had gone to negotiate with the Nazis some sort of a deal where Jews would be able to leave Germany and have eventually their assets transferred to Palestine, and goods would be sent from Palestine to Germany in exchange. There were people who believed that any negotiation whatsoever with the Nazis for whatever purpose was entirely unthinkable, and Arlozorov is out on the Tel Aviv beach when he gets back from Europe with his wife. In the dark, two gunmen approach. He's killed. Stavsky is arrested and charged with the murder. He is eventually convicted. It's a long legal process that we won't go through. He's convicted, and then the conviction is overturned. And so, ironically, Stavsky, who was accused of killing Arlozorov, which was really Israel's or the Yishuv's first well-known political murder, dies on the Altalena. And again, in terms of ironies, to think that Stavsky and Yitzhak Rabin are involved in the very same incident, the first political murder, the second political murder, is really, again, just really unbelievable. Among those who survived the Altalena, which was, of course, most of the people on board, was Yechiel Kadishai, that very same man who we'd heard about, who saw Begin stand up at the meeting and said that the only way to save Hungarian Jewry was to attack the British in Palestine. That very man had been asked by Begin to go to Rome and blow up the British embassy in Rome, which he did. And after having done that, he needed to hitch a ride back to Palestine. He heard there was a boat leaving. He got onto the Altalena, which he did not think would be such an exciting ride back, but he survives. Dalesky, the South African soldier who fired the cannon and ultimately sank the Altalena, became a scholar of Israeli literature, became a scholar of literature, and received the Israel Prize as one of Israel's outstanding academics. So he becomes a person of some renown in Israel, and throughout his life gives several interviews. And he says on more than one occasion that if there were any one day from his life that he could erase, it would have been the day that he fired that cannon. Ben-Gurion, on the other hand, when he was reporting about that day, said that the cannon was so sacred that it should stand right next to the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, if the temple should ever be rebuilt. Now, this is, of course, David Ben-Gurion, who had no interest in the temple being rebuilt, but for the sake of metaphorical power, said that it was so sacred, this cannon, which had done such an important thing, that if the temple ever was rebuilt, that the cannon should stand right next to the temple. A couple days later, on June 24th, the Palmach stormed the Etzel's headquarters. They smashed up the furniture. They tore up files. Begin had given an order very clearly, no matter what they do, there is to be no violence whatsoever. And people who witnessed it said that the young Irgun men stood there white-faced as the Palmach people came in and tore everything up and destroyed the offices and did what they did. Immediately thereafter, much of the leadership of the Irgun was arrested. Menachem Begin was far too public a person to arrest. It would have created enormous unrest to arrest him. So he wasn't arrested, but many of the others were. They were eventually released in August. But again, Ben-Gurion went as far as to now arrest many of the Irgun members that he had not been able to arrest before the state was created. We talked last time about how later on in his life, Menachem Begin gave an interview, really towards the very end of his life, when he was asked about the sergeant's affair and how he felt about it in retrospect. And we said that he called it a brutal act. He didn't exactly apologize for it. And he did note that after that brutal act, the British never hanged any Jews or Arabs in Palestine again. But nonetheless, he did call it a brutal act. Ben-Gurion in 1965 gave an interview about the Altalena. And the evidence was overwhelming that Menachem Begin had been telling the truth. The evidence was overwhelming that David Ben-Gurion knew that Menachem Begin was telling the truth. And to the reporter who was interviewing him, what David Ben-Gurion says was, perhaps I was mistaken. That was as far as he would go. That's basically the end of the Altalena story, except it's worth noting with some degree of irony that it was ultimately the Lehi and not David Ben-Gurion that got Begin to shut down the Etzel finally. Members of the Lehi assassinated Folk Bernadotte, who was the UN Security Council mediator in the Israeli-Arab conflict, in September 1948. For those of you that know Jerusalem, they assassinated him on the corner of HaPalmach Street and Gdud HaIvri. So if you take Gdud HaIvri up right where Halamed Hay forces you to turn, but you can come down the street, right up the street, right there at HaPalmach, is where they ambushed him. They put a car in the street. The car had to stop. They ambushed him. They killed him. The Lehi killed him. We know that the Lehi had a much more extremist policy than the Irgun all along about killing civilians and non-combatants and so on and so forth. The Lehi killed Bernadotte because they understood, and it's not clear whether rightly or wrongly, that he was negotiating as part of the settlement for many of the Palestinians, Arabs, call them what you will, who had fled the fighting and moved outside the territory of the State of Israel to be returned as part of the ending of the war for an array of reasons. They were opposed to that and they killed him. But if David Ben-Gurion was worried about how Israel was going to look by virtue of violating the embargo at the end of May and the beginning of June, to have the UN Security Council mediator assassinated in daylight in the middle of Jerusalem in September was just unbearable. And that was it. The body was actually taken first to the YMCA, those of you who know Jerusalem, and then it was taken home to Europe where he was from. He left, tragically, a widow and a young son. And Ben-Gurion had had it, and he made it clear to the Eitzel and the Irgun that it was over, and they were going to be completely disbanded immediately. And Begin understood that this time there was going to be no trifling with Ben-Gurion. He understood that what the Lehi had done had made Israel look simply terrible, and it was time. So on September 20th, the Etzel was basically completely disbanded, and Begin personally ordered all of his fighters to enter into units in the IDF to hand over all of their military equipment within 24 hours, and they did. But ironically, again, it was not David Ben-Gurion who brought that about. It was actually the assassination of Bernadotte by the Lehi. In November, by the way, Ben-Gurion, so we understand that he was interested in creating unity in Sahel, not only with the Irgun and the Lehi, Ben-Gurion shut down the Palmach. The Palmach had been the strike force of the Haganah. It was home of Yigal Alon. It was home of Yitzhak Rabin. It was home to many of Israel's early leaders. And it was a source of great pride for these men that they ran the Palmach, which was really a very well-trained outfit. And Ben-Gurion shut it down. He shut it down for a whole array of reasons, partly because he didn't want a different military elite that might give challenge to the political elite. It also seems to have been a way to assuage the Lehi and the Irgun that it wasn't only them that he was shutting it down. It caused tremendous anger among the ranks of the Palmach, and many members of the Palmach never forgave Ben-Gurion, but that's for a Ben-Gurion narrative, not for a Begin narrative. I just want to share one personal story to remind us all about how recent all of this is. I have a kind of a third cousin who's now 97, but when this story took place, he was about 92, I guess. And my book on Begin had just come out, and my wife and I were going to visit him up in the Galil where he lives with his wife. And my wife said we had to bring him something, and we had forgotten. We couldn't find anything to bring, so we went to the local bookstore in the city where he lived, and we went to Stymatsky's and bought him a copy of my Begin book, and I brought it to him. And he looks at the book. He's an old, cantankerous, kind of a tough guy. And he looks at the book and he says to me, "Did you know Begin?" As if you didn't know Begin, you couldn't write a book about Begin. You know, people write about Hamilton, Jefferson, Washington. But okay, he's an old guy. He said, "Did you know Begin?" And to kind of lessen the tension in the room, I said, "No, I actually didn't. Did you know Begin?" And he said to me without even cracking a smile, "No, I never met him, but I shot at him." And then he told me, of course, that he was among the Haganah forces on the day of the Altalena. So I told him that he may have felt bad about missing, but I was personally very glad that he missed because Israeli history would have played out very, very differently. The Altalena is important for a whole array of reasons. It's important for us to remember that Ben-Gurion, really in a matter of genius and foresight, understood that a Syrian state couldn't have multiple fighting forces, go to Gaza, Hamas, the PFLP, Islamic Jihad, it goes on without limit. One of the things that Israel was able to do that no Palestinian authority or anybody else has been able to do has been to actually create one single fighting force that would be held accountable to a civilian government. That's one thing that's important. The other thing that's important is that when people say if X or Y happens, Israel could descend into civil war, and you roll your eyes and you say, "Oh my God, that can't possibly happen." It's happened. Now, again, we would never replicate those exact scenarios, but the fact of the matter is, and many people don't know this, that there was a moment in Israeli history when Israeli soldiers fired on other Israeli soldiers, and people were killed. Anyway, shortly after the Altalena, 1949, the first elections are held. There's a beautiful story about how these first elections are held, about how they were entirely peaceful, they were entirely orderly. There was a sense of religious spirituality among many people who wrote beautifully about what it felt like. People said Shehechiyanu before they voted. Some people, religious, pious people, wrote about how they put on Shabbat clothing, went to vote, then came home and put on tefillin and prayed in the morning. Which says an extraordinary thing. The level of voting was very high. Chayrut got only 14 seats relative to Ben-Gurion's party, which got 46. And then a few years later, in the 51 elections, Chayrut declines to 8 seats in the Knesset from 14. We've mentioned briefly, and we'll briefly mention it again now, that there has always been a suspicion that Menachem Begin battled dark moments. And I believe that I mentioned earlier that there is actually a biography that was written about Begin, which is a kind of a psychological biography. I'm not a big fan of psychobiographies. I think that they only capture one part of the person, and there's, by definition, a huge amount of guesswork. But it's possible that he did have periods of great personal darkness. And if he did, this was one of them. After Chayrut declines from 14 to 8 in 1951, and he announces that he's leaving politics. He resigns from the Knesset. He actually rents a house somewhere outside of Jerusalem. It's when he goes and writes one of his two books. He writes The Revolt. He'll write White Nights a few years later. And in 1951, as he's outside of Jerusalem, very quiet, outside of all of the ruckus of the early state machinations, David Ben-Gurion makes a public announcement. He makes an announcement that he is exploring with Germany the possibility of Germany paying reparations to Israel. The German word for reparations is Wiedergutmachung, which if you break up the German word, Wieder is again, like Auf Wiedersehen. Gut is obviously good, like Good Shabbos, Good Yantif. And Machung is to make or do, like Was machst du? What are you doing or how are you doing and so forth. So Wiedergutmachung means to make things good again. That's what the German word reparations actually means. And there are people mostly on the right, mostly among the revisionists, also Begin, but he's out of the picture for the time being, who believe that taking money from Germany is the most inconceivable thing that a Jewish state worth its soul could possibly do. Don't forget Hadar. Konrad Adenauer then says explicitly in 1951, September of 1951, that he wants to address the issue of national restitution. And by the way, Israeli passports issued in that period said valid in all countries except for Germany. And it wasn't because Germany would not recognize Israeli passports. Israel refused to issue passports that could be used in Germany. I mean, that was the level of hatred, quite understandably, in 1951 for Germany. And Israel erupted into fury when now both Ben-Gurion and Konrad Adenauer announced that they are going to begin to look into this. There's cartoons in the press of the Germans reaching out and handing Israel bags of money where over the outstretched arm there are crematoria, there are gas chambers, there's dead children, all kinds of horrific things, and the vitriol becomes quite serious. Begin is tempted to get into this whole issue, but he decides not to until Yochanan Bader, the same childhood friend who had encouraged him to join the Polish Free Army, goes to Begin and says, "You owe it to your family to fight this horror." Bader will also play a kind of an ironic role in Begin's life, in that in all of the years, the 29 years that Menachem Begin sat in the Knesset in the opposition, David Ben-Gurion never once uttered his name. He would refer to him as the man sitting next to M.K. Bader. I mean, that level of hatred was there between these two men at a certain point. Anyway, Bader says to Begin, you've got to get involved in this. You're the only person who can turn this around. So in 1952, Begin actually begins a bit of a return to the political arena. In January of 52, he speaks in Tel Aviv in front of 10,000 people. Some of them are carrying Sifrei Torah, which brings a whole religious dimension to what is on the surface only a political issue. And Begin puts on a kippah. Now, we're all used to seeing pictures of Begin putting on a kippah after he's elected in 1977 and many other cases. But he had not walked around earlier years wearing a kippah. He puts on a kippah at that point, and he speaks publicly about Amalek, right? Evil that cannot in any way be compromised with. The command that God gives the Jews in the Torah, of course, is to destroy the Amalek and limchot et zecher Amalek, right? You should actually erase Amalek's memory altogether. It's very clear what he is saying. And in his rhetoric, by the way, he says, if this goes through, his people at least will refuse to pay taxes. Don't forget that under the British, they had robbed banks claiming that the British had taken their taxes illegally or unjustifiably. And now they were saying they weren't going to pay taxes to the Jewish state. On January 6th, which is a day later, David Ben-Gurion announces that the Knesset is going to debate it, and this reaches its apex one day later on January 7th. It is a cold, wintry, rainy Jerusalem day, and there is a huge demonstration in Kikar Tzion, at Zion Square, at the very, very bottom of the of Ben Yehuda Street and so forth. And Begin gives what is one of the most transformative speeches of his entire life. It goes on for a very long time in front of a very angry crowd that is getting more and more riled up as time goes by. But I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs to give you a sense of the profundity and the energy of the language. He says, "The most shameful event that has ever occurred in the history of our people," that's a pretty powerful statement, "is about to take place this evening. At this bitter hour, we recall our hallowed fathers, our slaughtered mothers," his father and his mother and his brother, "and our babies who were led by the millions to the slaughter at the hands of Satan, who emerged from the very bottom of hell to annihilate the remnant of our people." And then he went on, "They," the government, "are on the verge of signing an accord with Germany and saying that Germany is a nation and not what it really is. A pack of wolves whose fangs devoured and consumed our people. And even though that blood was spilled like water, it was not for naught. It gave us the strength to rise up against the British enslaver." Here the biblical allusion, now the British are the Egyptians. "Because we always asked ourselves how we were better than our slaughtered forefathers and why they are dead and we are alive. That blood, the holy and sanctified blood, taught us to fight and led us into the enemy's battlefield. And it is thanks to that blood that Ben-Gurion, that little tyrant and big maniac, became prime minister." And then Begin went further a little bit later in his speech, and he may have gone too far. "Mr. Ben-Gurion has sent policemen here, according to information we have just received, grenades and tear gas made in Germany." Don't know if it was true or not true. "The same gases that choked our fathers. He has jails and concentration camps." That was not true. "Ben-Gurion is indeed older than I, but I am more experienced in standing up to a wicked government. And therefore I am announcing evil is standing before a just cause." But evil now is not the Germans. Evil now is Ben-Gurion. "And it will shatter like a rock, like a glass against rock. You will collect taxes by force, services by force. Nothing will be given to your state by our own free will. You will not have enough prisons to hold all the prisoners." And then a sentence or two later, he utters a sentence that I believe, if he could have taken it back, he would have, but he couldn't. And he said, "When you fired your cannon on me during the Altalin episode," he meant, of course, "I gave the order no. I will give the order yes today. You will no longer be a Jewish government, and you will not have moral authority." There were and are many people who understood that sentence as threatening violence on the Israeli government. Think about Dalesky not wanting to use the cannon. Think about the Machal pilots not wanting to bomb the ship. Think about Begin on the beach and then on the radio telling people not to fire. And now, in a moment of complete fervor, he says something that he certainly shouldn't have and may have actually regretted. 5:30 in the afternoon, he finishes his speech and he begins to hike up Ben Yehuda Street, which many people know, of course, to the Knesset building. The Knesset building that we all know now is a much newer building. It was completed in August of 1966. Until then, the Knesset is more or less on the corner of Ben Yehuda and King George. If you walk up Ben Yehuda Street and make a little bit of a left, on the other side of the street on King George, go back, I don't know, 75 yards, 100 yards, there's a building that's now being repaired and made into a museum of the history of the Knesset. But back then, that's where the Knesset actually met. And there's still a little plaque on the building you can see even today. And there is bedlam outside the Knesset, because it's a couple hundred yards to walk up Ben Yehuda. And he walks, and so do the thousands and thousands of people whom he's just riled up. He, of course, goes into the Knesset. But outside the Knesset, his people are demonstrating and getting very, very agitated. And the police use tear gas to disperse them. But then someone throws a rock through the window of the Knesset, so the tear gas actually also enters the Knesset. So there's bedlam outside, there's bedlam inside. There's a lot of stuff that's happening. We'll skip most of it, but at a certain point, Ben-Gurion says out loud, "Who brought these hooligans here?" To which Begin says to Ben-Gurion, "You are the hooligan." And at that moment, the Speaker of the Knesset had had more than enough. He demands an apology from Begin. The proceedings are disrupted. The army is actually brought in to restore order. 140 people are arrested. Hundreds of both protesters and police are brought to hospitals with injuries. And the police, proving Begin correct, actually raided the Chayrut headquarters, just like they had raided the Irgun headquarters after the Altalena. And Begin was banned from the Knesset for 3 months. He had been sworn in that night, but then he was banned from the Knesset for 3 months. On January 9th, basically immediately thereafter, the Knesset voted 61-50 to accept the deal and to have Germany pay reparations. And with that money, which Germany did pay, Israel built many of its roads. It built the national water carrier. It built a huge part of its infrastructure. It built its telecommunications network. And by the mid-1950s, Israel had the world's fastest growing economy. That's a pretty extraordinary thing for a country that just a few years earlier was crumbling under the weight of the hundreds of thousands of Jews who were coming from North Africa because they were being kicked out of all those countries, survivors who were coming, people who were living in Ma'abarot, these immigrant hut towns that were horrible in the summer and horrible in the winter. And so by the mid-1950s, because of German reparations, Israel actually has the world's fastest growing economy. I want to share with you one other personal story. When I started working on the Begin biography, I wrote all three of the Begin kids through Benny Begin, who's kind of the spokesperson for the three children. And I told them that I was going to work on this biography, and I would be very honored if I could interview any or all of them. I knew up front that they were not going to do it because I knew other people who'd written biographies of Begin, and they had all said that they were not doing any of that. They didn't actually get involved in building of the Begin Heritage Center. They dealt with Begin, their father, and they let the public deal with Begin, the prime minister and the public person. But it has to be said, Benny Begin, who is in many ways just like his father, he's not the fiery personality, he hasn't had the same political career, but he is as straight as an arrow and as honest and as thoughtful as his father was, has spent really a lifetime speaking about his father, defending his father's honor in an extraordinarily dignified and noble way. And after the book was written, I sent him a copy of the book. And I wrote him a note and I said, "I know you didn't want to be involved in the research for the book, but I wanted you to have a copy. And I hope that if you read it, that you'll feel that I did your father the dignity that I was trying very hard to do him." A week goes by, my cell phone rings, I pull it out of my back pocket, screen says Benny Begin. And I thought, uh-oh, this is not going to be good. He eventually came to my office like a week or two later. We sat for 3 hours where he had marked up the book left and right. Some of the things were matters of opinion. Some of the things were matters of fact. We agreed about some. We didn't agree about others. But I want to share with you just one story. As we're working our way through the book, we get to the reparations chapter. And he says to me, "You know, you were very hard on Ben-Gurion in that chapter." So I kind of looked at him and said, "Well, yeah." And then he said, "You have to remember this. My father didn't have to feed anybody. My father didn't have to put a roof over anybody. My father was the head of the opposition. Ben-Gurion needed to feed people. Ben-Gurion needed to house people. What else was he supposed to do?" And I thought that was just an extraordinary statement from a man who reveres his father, who has time and time again defended his father in all sorts of ways, to have the distance to say his father said one thing and his father wasn't wrong, but by the same token, Ben-Gurion, who did something else, might not have been wrong either. It's important for us also to remember that that was not the end, of course, of the story of the Shoah, of the story of the Holocaust in Israeli life. In 1953, very shortly thereafter, Yad Vashem is established and has become, of course, the world's leading historical research institute about the Holocaust. And in 1960, David Ben-Gurion will go back to the plenum of the Knesset and announce that Israel has captured Adolf Eichmann and has secreted him out of Buenos Aires and has already brought him to Israel, where he is going to stand trial. So Begin's having lost the reparations battle in the early 1950s did not mean that he lost the battle for putting the Holocaust on the map of Israeli discourse. He definitely did, in fact, contribute to that. As we saw in the case of the sergeants last time, and now in the case of the reparations battle this time, Begin could be a person whose ramrod straightforwardness, unwillingness to bend or waver, might have gotten him to do things that in retrospect he wished he hadn't done, or to say things that he wished he hadn't said. He lost this particular battle. His reputation took a very serious hit because of what he had said in Kikar Tzion, but he had been resurrected as a serious political force. He had been resurrected as a personality that had to be reckoned with in Israel. And he didn't know it then, and nobody else did, but he had actually started out on the road to becoming Israel's Jewish prime minister. Now, the Ashkenazi made fun of him. They said, look how un-Israeli you are. You still think you're in Poland. You're going to Yerucham, you're going to Sderot. It's 95 or 100 degrees outside, and you're wearing in a suit and a tie. What's wrong with you? But the Mizrahim didn't have that reaction. They said Ben-Gurion comes and he campaigns, so he's wearing shorts and a t-shirt. And Begin dresses up to come and speak to us.